Now, this is Penn Jillette on the CBS Radio Free FM, and I'm sitting here with Michael Goodeau, PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. And we have another radio guy on the air, and this is Paul Harris, who's been doing radio in St. Louis. Has been St. Louis most of the time?
St. Louis for 8 years, D.C. for 13. That's where I first met you.
Yeah, and you were asking me to come on the show to pimp identity and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. I didn't have any time to get on your show.
I know.
So I'm having you on my show.
Okay,
so that's the way it works out.
Yeah.
And one of the things we had in common, this is, you know, this show often turns into Penn's skeptical friends. skeptical of their friendship with me, I suppose. But you've been a hardcore skeptic for the whole time you've been on radio.
Yeah.
And you do a full show in St. Louis, and is it mostly the skeptical bent?
First of all, it's 4 hours a day. I know you can't imagine.
No,
four hours a day. It's 20 hours a week.
Right. So we should have
real radio.
Absolutely nothing that we have to do here.
No.
You should be able to do this amount of time
in
your sleep.
It's funny. I was just talking to somebody about you last week because I was bringing you up as the prototypical guest that I love having on, because I know if I have you on for an hour, I have to think of three questions.
we're talking. You know, we have Joe Rogan on and people like that. And when I used to do a lot of radio interviews, you know, you find out that radio guys have talked about everything they possibly could have in their mind.
Yeah.
And they were done with that years ago.
Yep.
So if they can ask you, you know, how are you doing today, Penn, and then break after 18 minutes, they're just thrilled to pieces. So I was saying, you know, what have you learned, Goodeau, from doing radio? And we were saying, be very, very aggressive. Answer three questions every one you're asked,
yep.
Give very long answers, and then accelerate toward the end.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a story about the first time I met you. It was in Washington, D.C. I was on a morning show then. I did mornings for 15 years. Now I'm doing afternoons. And you and Teller came to Washington, D.C. to play either the Warner or the National Theater. I can't remember which it was. And we invited you to come in and do the show with me one morning. And you were supposed to get there at 7 o'clock, and you showed up at 6:30.
I'm always early.
And you were supposed to play around with us for maybe an hour, and then you had to go somewhere else, and you stayed till 9:30. and it was the day that Chip and Grace Denman were having a thing with Randy at the University of Maryland. And you said, you should come. I know you love Randy. You should come to this thing tonight. And so I did. I think it was actually in the afternoon because you were performing that night.
Yeah.
And you said, come to this, and you did some juggling and some fire eating, and then you introduced Randy. And afterwards...
Oh, yeah, I remember that game. Yeah.
Afterwards, you invited me to come backstage and meet him, and you introduced me this way. You said, this is the smartest guy I know in radio. And then you paused, and Randy was about to say something, and you said, of course, that's not saying much.
That's not much at all. No, that's the shortest guy in basketball. That's the tallest jockey.
And so that's like 20 years ago, I think, something like that.
And that sucked you into the camp.
Absolutely. And I've been a huge Randy fan, you know, ever since seeing him on Carson as a child and then reading Flim Flam and The Faith Healers and all of those great books that he had. So I thank you for the personal introduction there, and I've kind of been friendly with him for these two decades.
Well, you know, don't you find, you know, we do Bulls hit and we do a lot of skeptical stuff, and people and Matt and Trey of South Park always talk about this, but you're given a very lot of credit for being so brave to come out against these things and say this stuff, and I find, and so have Matt and Trey, that when you do this stuff, you just get praise.
Yes.
You don't get the negative stuff, but you're more, you know, like you said, you're on the radio more, you talk about more things,
yeah.
You have people calling in,
yep.
And you have a little bit more time in the trenches. How much negative stuff do you get?
Very, very little about this. I get a lot of people who will twist anything you say into political stuff. You know, you could be talking about, I got new curtains for the house. Why do you hate Bush? You know, that's the kind of response you get. But when I do things like this, and I'll give you a perfect example. The two missing boys, Sean Hornbeck and Ben Ownby, that was a huge story because it happened in suburban St. Louis.
And
had been huge stories for us for 4 years, plus other missing kids that had still not been found. But this Ben Ownby thing had kind of been the major story on our show all week long. And then on that Friday afternoon, they found the two boys at 4:30, which is right in the heart of my show. I'm on from 2 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
So the news came in. They have found these two kids, and we took the sheriff's press conference live and all that sort of stuff. And so it was a major topic on Friday. Well, now it's the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to be the weekend an ice storm came to town. Perfect confluence of events that would have made for great radio if only I'd been on the air. But I come back on Monday afternoon, and there's this wonderful story that is still lingering from the previous Friday, plus there's the news of what Sylvia Brown and James Von Prague had predicted,
mm-hmm.
which Robert Lancaster had, I think you had him
yeah,
on.
Yeah, Dr. Robert Lund, yeah.
And all of that sort of stuff. So I not only talked about how wonderful it was that these boys were safe and hopefully mentally sound, but also really went after Sylvia Brown and James Von Prague. All I get from that is thank you for saying it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for coming out and doing that. And I did that on Monday afternoon. And on Wednesday, I'm working at home, getting the show together, and I get an email from a listener who says, you have to put on Channel 4 right now. Montel is on and Sylvia Brown is on. Maybe she'll apologize for getting it wrong.
Yeah, well, that seems likely. You're not going to miss that.
And
that'll be a big deal, her apologizing.
This guy was a big fan of my show, and he actually wrote in his email, I never watch Montel, but I was flicking around looking for something to watch, mm-hmm. and I came across this, and I had to email you because I know you're at your computer. So I emailed back, and I said, I'm not going to bother putting it on because, A, I know two things about show business. One, this was probably filmed a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. It's not like he does his show live. And number two, Sylvia is never going to admit she was wrong or apologize. She will give lame excuses that will probably come out, or, if I know Sylvia, at some point she'll say that she predicted this would actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
She'll deny getting it wrong and say, I actually got it right. She'll twist it and spin it some way.
And most of all, not give you the soundbite.
Right.
You know, even while she's apologizing, she'll never say the sentence, it might look as though I got it wrong, because then you could pull that out. She won't give you anything to quote.
In fact, there was no audio from her whatsoever. It was just that statement from her business manager that made it to Anderson Cooper's show a couple of nights later, the one that Randy was on. So when I do that sort of stuff, I never have anybody say, how can you possibly attack Sylvia Brown? How can you go out? These people are real. I never hear from those people.
It's surprising, isn't it? You know, when we first did the first season of Bull's Hit, we kind of hunkered down. You know, we kind of covered our heads and said, uh-oh, here it comes,
mm-hmm.
because these people are so successful. But I use this, and it never happened. It never happened. You know, as Trey and Matt said, you know, we did fart jokes on TV, and they threw money at us.
Yeah.
We got more offensive, and they threw more money at us.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like the only people that agree on this are the right-wing nuts and the actual creative people. Because the right-wing nuts say, the more they do this outrageous stuff, the more money you give them. And the artists go, yeah. And only one of us is upset about that.
Yeah.
But I use, and I get asked this question all the time, and since you have more contact with just people that can just call in and get to you easier and for more length of time, there's this principle I use, which is called the George Harrison principle to me. In A Hard Day's Night, there's a moment where George Harrison drifts away from the rest of the Fab Four, from those other lovable mop tops, and he falls into a room that's this classic advertising room.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some people that are selling shirts and designs, and they don't recognize George Harrison as one of the Beatles. They just think he's another pimply-faced kid that's in their demographic.
Right.
And they ask him about this TV show that's the number one rated TV show for teens, you know, and they ask him if he watches it, you know, and he says, yes, I do. And they're all on Twitter. We have the perfect audience. And then he says, we like to put it on, make rude comments, and have a laugh. You know, and they don't really know what to do with that. And I always think, whenever they talk about the ratings of John Edward, especially skeptics, automatically assume that every single other person watching is buying it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if on people like Sylvia Brown, on Montel, and so on, if the percentage of people that are buying it at completely is very, very low, and the number of people that are kind of wishy-washy is pretty low, too, and the kind of people just letting it float over them is the vast majority.
Well, she gets big ratings for him, so she's drawing more people than are normally there. I think at least half of those are bloggers. who are just waiting to write something about it. But I do think that there are people who are true Sylvia believers. I think that the Venn diagram of true Sylvia believers who watch her on Montel and Paul Harris Show listeners on KMOX in St. Louis, the circles do not overlap at all, or if they do, just at the perimeter.
And if you ever, at that level, you know, I talk about, Trey and Matt and about us doing shows, but at the level of St. Louis radio, have you ever had your bosses tell you it's too skeptical, don't go there?
No.
And do you ever go religion? Do you ever do religion stuff?
No, I don't talk about religion.
You do absolutely just pure skeptical stuff.
Well, you know, the closest we would come to religion is in Missouri. We had the big debate over stem cell because it was a huge issue there.
Oh, sure.
And now
sure.
It's going national. And again, that Venn diagram overlaps a lot.
Yeah.
The stem cell issue in religion. So I will talk about that, but I'll bring the scientists on to talk about it, the professors from Washington University in St. Louis who are leading the field, and I'll bring them on, and then we'll hear from the Missouri Right to Life people who want to have equal time, and I'll say no.
Uh-huh.
And now that's when the hate mail comes in.
Uh-huh. And you say no on the air. You say we're not going to have these people on, they're going to talk to them? Yeah, and what is the kind of hate mail do you get? Just you're not being fair, or do you get more personal attacks?
I get a lot of personal attacks. In fact, there are some email addresses and domains that I've actually had to put in my filter so that I don't get them because they can be so disturbing. Because I read all of, unlike you, I read all of my. I don't have a Godot sitting there.
I'm reading all the email.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just have mine forwarded to you and you can filter that for me too. So I read it. And after a while, I would get to one and it would be somebody who would write something nice or somebody has a question about the show or whatever it is. And then I would get to some of these that are really disturbing in their attacks. And by the way, I find that the more religious the person, the more vicious the attack. And I wonder how those two go together.
Yeah, but I also wonder in that person's mind, because you also have to be a little bit fair in saying maybe some of the most religious aren't listening to you
and
don't bother writing.
No, these are the people who fit into the whack job category.
Yeah,
not the religious category, but the whack job category, which to me is not the same thing.
Right. That does overlap occasionally.
Yeah. Once again, let's get Venn diagram in again. How many times can we mention it?
Let's bring Venn in and draw it up.
It's VennRadio.com.
And what would you say is your percentage of your show that is skeptical themes?
Well, I don't think I do shows that are specifically skeptical themes. Mm-hmm. I think there's always a skeptical bent to whatever I'm talking about, although some of it's just goofy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything I talk about is some hot topic that is destined to get me angry email. Sometimes it's talking about television or radio or film or whatever else is going on in the world, sports or whatever it is.
Anyone whose job it is to know stuff, mm-hmm. I always ask them where they get the information. What papers you read, what order you read it in, where do you get the information?
I get a ton of stuff online, but I read three newspapers every day, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal, only because they're hard to get directly to online to find out what is the top of the chart there. Other stuff that I want to read online, I read blogs, I read network websites, I read newspapers. I probably go through 3 or 4 hours of preparation every morning working on whatever the show's going to be.
See, we go through about 2 hours of preparation for 1 hour.
Yeah.
So see the quality we're doing in that 1 hour, the concentration is so much different.
We're poor readers. Very slow is really the problem.
Well, we get to do pretty much one topic. If our producer has his way, we do one topic.
Mm-hmm.
If we have our way, we do six topics, half-assed, take calls alternating on them, pay no attention to who's calling about what, ask the people the wrong question for what they're calling in for. That's what we like to do. That's our view of radio.
Right.
Then you have the producer's view of staying on one subject. And now, how'd you get into radio from?
I started doing it in high school. Every high school has the assistant principal who reads the announcements in the morning over the PA about what club is going to meet wherever it was. Some friends of mine, I was not in on this originally, some friends of mine went to him and said, why don't you let the students do that? That way the other students will listen. Mm-hmm. Because no one's paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
he did not take this as an insult. He actually took it as a good idea and decided to let them do it. And after my friends were doing it, I said, well, that's cool. I want to do that, too. And then eventually they talked him into building a little production studio in the school.
Yeah.
They let us play rock and roll at lunchtime into the cafeterias. And we were doing like a whole produced morning show for like 15 minutes during homeroom for everybody. And I was completely enamored of it. I had grown up outside of New York City listening to some of the greatest radio talents in the world. Mm-hmm. And kind of wanted to see if that was as much fun as it seemed like it was, and turned out it was.
But have you always been in talk, or did you also do...
I did music radio for a long time. I started out as a disc jockey. Mm-hmm. First song I ever played on commercial radio was More Than a Feeling by Boston, at the wrong speed. Thank you very much. I was a little bit nervous. It was a Saturday night.
Is it a little better at the wrong speed?
It's no worse.
Okay, because I've never liked Boston.
Tried playing it 100 times.
Yeah, we had that in my school. We had announcements in the morning, and I got myself to be able to do them.
You know,
good morning today is a B-day. Classes are scheduled as followed. And it was finally, I would end usually the broadcast. I guess you can call it that, up to 300 students or so. I would end the broadcast with a little joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that went really well for about a week. Then it was the wrong little joke.
Exactly.
And it was back to the vice principal reading it.
Yeah. So that was your first instance of dealing with radio management, right there.
I was oppressed.
Here's what you can do. Here's what you can't do. Here's where censorship comes
and
in.
And it happened. There wasn't any sort of censorship, really. It wasn't any sort of like, don't say stuff like that anymore. It was just, you're gone. You did not exist. You had nothing to do with this. You're out of this. You're out of radio.
I've been fired from a couple of radio jobs, but I've never had somebody come in and say, because of what you said.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a second. Let me take that back. I was almost fired from that job in Washington where I met you, and I ended up being on the air for over 5 years. But after the Exxon Valdez happened, I said, I wonder if people are going to cut up their Exxon cards now or not do business with Exxon. And the general manager called me into the office after the show and said, we do business with Exxon here, a large amount here, and you can't say stuff like that. And I said, well, okay, so what are the restrictions going to be on what I can say? Because I don't have a list of who we are doing business with or who we're potentially going to do business with. I haven't heard any Exxon commercials on my show. He said, well, you know, we have sort of a trade deal with them, and it's a corporate thing. And I said, well, okay, so how am I going to know what those are? He said, well, you just have to be careful. I said, that's not a guideline of any kind. Like you're basically putting quicksand down and telling me to go for a walk. He said, well, I'll let you know when you get close to the quicksand. Well, okay.
That was it. That was
fine.
The meeting.
I never had another meeting with him about content for the rest of the time there.
Just that one Exxon thing.
That was it, yeah.
Well, don't cut up your credit cards. This is we're here with Paul Harris, Michael Goodoe, as always, and we're chatting here on the Penn Jillette Show, CBS Radio, Free FM. Yeah, this is Penn, CBS Radio, Free FM. And we're talking about radio, very self-referential, very Letterman, very Dennis Miller.
Very inside.
Very inside. We're talking, and Michael Goodoe is here. We have Paul Harris, who I guess I've been interviewed by a zillion times in the past 20 years, and finally getting a chance to interview. It's a hard thing, doing interviews.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's a hard thing. The reason I said you were one of the smartest guys in radio is you have no idea what it's like to travel around this country and get up, you know, go to sleep at 2 a.m. and then get up at 4 a.m. And go on the radio with a different guy every morning. You know, it is incredible the things these guys think of in the shower. And it's always Penn, before I came on here, I had an idea in the shower this morning.
Uh-huh.
An idea in there. I'm going to pretend Teller's here, okay? I'm going to pretend Teller's here. And then I'll ask some questions, and you just don't say anything. Don't say anything. You know, that's always what they would do.
Yeah.
Always the same idea. And then they'd go, so Teller, how you doing? And they'd hold up and go, shh. Make sure I remember the gag. And I'd go, oh, what are you talking about? Teller's not here. And they go, oh, you debunker, you.
Yeah.
Ooh, you busted me.
Yeah.
Oh, you busted me. Let's have some more music coming up.
On the morning zoo.
Yeah, the morning.
Oh, I feel for you. I can imagine what it was like having to go around and do those.
But they sell tickets, and you'll find basic rules of being interviewed are don't ever answer the question you were asked. Mm-hmm. Answer the question that you intended to be asked.
Particularly if you have something to sell.
Yeah, exactly. When, no matter what they ask
I
you,
have nothing to sell here. That's my problem. I have no agenda. I have nothing to sell. If you ask me something, I'll tell you a story. That's all I got.
And that's one thing. Never answer the question they've asked you. And also, and this is advice I've given people, and you've interviewed a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
But the advice I give people is don't ever have a conversation. Don't ever really talk to the person because that will work terrific for your first two interviews, and then you will be broken because the game isn't played that way. And if you give yourself up emotionally to strangers that much, you will crack. Mm. And it's very funny because the advice I give people when they're going to do a radio show is to be plastic and give canned answers. Just because I know, you know, I've seen authors that you go out on the road to do, you know, this 3-week book promotional tour and you are crushed at the end of it because they're trying to, you know, the person asks them the question, how'd you first get the idea to do this book? And they do soul searching every time.
Yeah.
Every time they're going for, what's the real answer to this? Well, you know, I guess I kind of got interested in when I, you know, and that's where you get into all sorts of trouble. Do you ever interview Randy?
I have. Randy's been on many times.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But when I'm going to do an interview, my goal, and I think I learned this from watching Carson all those years, my goal is to make the other person look as good as possible by asking them questions I know will lead them down the path to a good story or whatever it is. I'm not interested in learning the subtleties of your personal life, or unless that's what you've written your book about or whatever it is. Those are the sort of things that there. However, I have two exceptions.
Okay.
Comedians.
Yeah.
Brian Regan and Jake Johansson. Do you know either of these guys?
Yes, I know both of them.
Both fantastic. I think among the most talented stand-ups of the last 10 or 15 years.
Oh, sure.
Who have both done my show. Every time they'd come through town, like you, they would come and hang out for much longer than they planned to because they were having such a good time. But after a while, they refused to tell me ahead of time what they wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they'd say, look, I got bits on this and this and this, and they would tell me that off the air, and I would lead them into the conversation so that we would get the funny stuff on so we'd sell some tickets for their show. After a while, they stopped doing that because they noticed if they told me what they wanted to talk about, I would purposely not ask them about it. Because I knew that they were going around and doing 100 shows in the course of a year and getting just every time they were telling the same thing.
And so you don't want the tried and true material.
I wanted to hear something different.
You know Alex Bennett, right?
Yeah.
Well, Alex Bennett used to do this thing. It used to kill me. I loved it when I was in the studio. He was doing it to other people. But then after I would do this, he would do it to me, and it made me crazy. He would... When a guy would go up on the satellite to do what I call these gangbangs, where you sit in a room and do 35 interviews one after the other.
7 minutes at a time.
Yeah, put you up on the satellite.
Yeah.
And they pop you around. What Alex would do is he would listen to the satellite for all the previous interviews. And he would find out what answers they'd given, what answers they had down, and then he would either ask them different stuff, or bust them, or play back part of what they said to someone
else.
So he was really, I mean, if you want to be brutal, you do those satellite things once in a while.
I refuse to do those satellite things. Because I don't think that I don't think there's a guest I want to have on my show who 7 minutes is enough for.
Osama bin Laden.
Exactly. Well, yeah. but I mean, even you, when you were doing the thing for Identity, you were doing, what, like 2 hours or so broken up into 7-minute segments.
Yeah.
And I know you did one with my colleague, John Grayson.
Sure.
But I actually, when I talked to your assistant, Glenn, to see if you were available, you were all booked up. And I thought, well, I don't want to just do 7 minutes with Ben because that's one question.
Well, part of one question. That's part of an answer. One question.
That's one question and half an answer.
Who are your favorite interviews? So, who are the favorite ones you've done?
I like comedians like that,
like
Brian and Jake. There's a guy in Chicago, a writer who used to be with Chicago Tribune for a long time by the name of Bob Green.
Oh, sure.
Who he writes books that are very sentimental and very emotional, but he is a fantastic storyteller. I'll give you an example. He wrote a book a few years ago called Fraternity, in which he told stories about meeting 5 presidents, from Nixon to Ford to Carter to the first Bush to Clinton, and told stories about them. So when Ford died, I emailed him and I said, Bob, you have to come on and tell some more Ford stories. And he comes on and he's got the stories ready to go about meeting the Secret Service and about just hanging out with Gerald Ford. He went with Ford to a clothing store where Ford was going to try on like a suit or a pair of pants or something. And Bob was stunned to find out that he just goes in there as Gerald Ford. You know, there's a Secret Service guy with him, but they don't call ahead and say, the former president is coming to your store. They don't do any of that. He just goes and he says, and so you stand there while the guy is trying you on and, you know, he's testing the checking the inseam and everything. He says, well, yes, why wouldn't I? I mean, so those are the kind of stories I turn to Bob for. And there are lots of people who are like that, who are just money in the bank kind of guests.
I was flying on an airplane once, and ahead of me was former President Ford and a Secret Service guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was flying with was Lawrence O'Donnell Jr., the executive producer of West Wing, who used to be senior advisor to Moynihan and is savvy in things political, although this doesn't show this directly. And he said, you ever been on a plane where you knew the guy ahead of you had a gun? The guy in front of you has a gun. Mm. There's a Secret Service guy in front of us. He has a gun.
Mm-hmm.
We're flying with a guy who has a gun. And he just kind of like, shh, quiet. Don't keep saying. He's got a gun. The guy's got a gun. You'll be able to see. If he gets up to go to the can, you'll see he has a gun.
Wow.
So I was thinking the whole time, just go, we're flying with a Secret Service guy that has a gun. Yeah, I hung out with
except you couldn't say gun out loud because you were on board a plane.
Gun. I hung out with Ronald Reagan Jr. Mm-hmm. quite a bit. And he, he was one of the first presidential family members to refuse Secret Service.
I didn't know that.
He did not have any Secret Service people. And this was at the time that his father was president.
Right.
And at the time when he was the number one hostage. You know, if you wanted to get a hostage, Ron Reagan Jr., name and everything, he was the one to get.
Absolutely.
And he told me a great thing where he said, we would go out and have lunch or hang out or something, and he'd never plan in advance or make reservations. That was part of his safety thing. That was his part. And he just went, you know, I've tried to look at the Secret Service literature to say if I'm kidnapped, if the Secret Service has been given actual instructions to just shoot me. He said, because I think in their playbook, the best thing to do is to shoot me. Because if they have me as a hostage, I'm much more dangerous to the country. Mm-hmm. He said, but I can't find out if that's true. But I'll tell you one thing for sure. If I'm kidnapped and you're there with me, both sides are shooting you. He's going, I can't even see the bow. Get the big guy out of the way. Bow. Just shoot him. Just drop him, would you? He said, both sides are going to be doing that. He said, if you look at the history of hostage taking, friends of the hostage have never done well.
No.
It's never like, we want him, you just run along.
That's
you
right.
Know? And the other side doesn't go, let's save Penn. Save Penn, and then we'll get to Ron Reagan Jr. We'll get to the just save Penn for a moment.
Yeah.
So,
Because if they held on to you, then the president would do what they want.
Exactly. So you just pop him just so we can think. Okay. We don't care who shoots him. Both sides need him. What's he doing, Walk? Why is he screaming and crying and peeing in his pants? Boom! Boom! We can't think with him. Boom! Okay, now there's a 300-pound pile there.
Right.
We can deal with that on the ground. Now let's deal with the hostage situation. Boom! So that's the image that's always been in my head anytime I'm around a president.
And then you would roll over and hold up the three of clubs and say, Is that your card?
Is that your card? I've always thought, you know, that that's where being a hostage has an upside to it.
Yes.
Because being a friend of a hostage just means absolute. And actually, after you told me that story, I didn't hang around with Ron Reagan. I was a little bit nervous.
Was there a celebrity chic to Ron Reagan Jr.? I mean, when you would be with him someplace, were there, that's the president's son.
It was a weird week in my life because I was in L.A., and I had some time off, which is very rare for me. And there were 2 days in a row. This was exactly the year it was, because Ronald Reagan was president. And I was in L.A., and I went to lunch with Ronald Reagan Jr., got home, got a phone call. It was Al Goldstein. It was right about the time that the Ayatollah had threatened Salman Rushdie and offered, you know, put a fatwa on his ass. And Al Goldstein had been very angry that a censorship issue had hit internationally, and he wasn't part of it. And this broke Al Goldstein's heart. So Al Goldstein took out a full-page ad in Screw, it's his magazine. He put a full-page ad in Screw that offered $1 million to anyone that killed the Ayatollah. And immediately, credulous death threats came into the Screw offices in New York.
Sure.
And the very same guys that had busted Al before were now at the office trying to protect him. And every secretary quit, every writer quit, they all left. And the Secret Service guys said, get out of town, go anywhere. Don't tell people where you are. Don't do any press stuff. And just get, go somewhere. So, of course, Al went to Beverly Hills.
Where Islamic fanatics could never find him.
Never find him. Never find him. And he called all his friends, and no one would hang out with him.
Uh-huh.
So he called me and said, hey, Pat, I'm in L.A. What are you doing? And I went, didn't you just threaten the Ayatollah? And I said, well, yeah. And I said, well, aren't they trying to kill you? He said, yeah, they're trying to kill me in New York. I'm okay in L.A. And I said, he said, I'm really lonely. No one will hang out with me. And I go, okay. He said, you want to go over to the Playboy Mansion? I go, okay. And that's one of those moments you just go, my life has become really surreal. I just got dropped off by Ron Reagan Jr., and now Al Goldstein wants to pick me up during his death threats to go over to the Playboy Mansion.
Wow.
And I said, okay, but I won't be around you when you start your car. You know, that's all I had. I don't want to walk in or out of any place with you. And he thought I was kidding, but I actually stuck with it. Because I just figure, okay, you get out of the car, you walk all the way in, then I'll get out of the car. Then you come out of the restaurant, you walk all the way to your car, you start it up, you drive around the block, then I'll walk out. You know, mm-hmm. Just make sure that I'm not, oh, what's it going on? Bang! Shoot the big guy. So that's what I get in my mind. And we went over to Hugh Hefner's house, and only I would be unlucky enough to be around Hugh Hefner at the only monogamous time in his life.
Oh, he was married then?
There was one woman at the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah.
And she came downstairs, and she looked at me and Al Goldstein and said, Hugh, one of these men threatened the Ayatollah. The other one drowns his partner. Why are they in our house? And we were thrown out of the Playboy Mansion.
Wow.
When nobody was there, just for being us.
Wow.
Just for being us is why we were thrown out.
I love Al's notion there that he can go to California to flee the fatwa that he got in New York.
Yeah.
Has he never seen a mafia movie?
I know. Well, that's, you know, that's Al.
I mean,
you know?
I mean, Paulie Walnuts is certainly going to be coming after you.
Yeah. I know. At Beverly Hills, where you'd never expect to find a Jew. You'd never look for a Jew in Beverly
That's
Hills.
That's right. Which,
the Muslims don't know that yet. We're with Paul Harris, Michael Godot. My name is Ped Gillette. We're on the free FM CBS radio. Ped Gillette, free FM CBS radio. That was the Mike Jones Enormous Orchestra playing the Ped Gillette theme with me on bass. PenRadio@gmail.com, PenRadio.com. I just got to butt in with this. People are writing us emails all the time asking how to be on Identity. We're shooting a bunch more of Identity, my big game show on NBC. And if you're in Chicago or Las Vegas, you can do this. Chicago, today, Friday and tomorrow, Saturday, February 9th and 10th, at the Hard Rock Cafe, 63 West Ontario Street, time 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., and Saturday, February 10th, time 12 noon to 5 p.m., you just show up, and you can be a contestant on Identity. We're going to do auditions for that. And if you're in Las Vegas, like I am, and you want to be a contestant, Monday and Tuesday, February 12th and 13th, the Doubletree Club at the Las Vegas Airport Hotel. That's on Pollock Drive, 7250 Pollock Drive, Las Vegas. That's Monday, February 12th from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. in the evening, and Tuesday, February 13th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Talking to Paul Harris, radio guy. Well, you know, radio guys in California are going to be in a lot of trouble for the water drinking thing and the Wii, right? It was Hold Your Wii for a Wii
station in Sacramento.
Just the lightest, easiest, slightly titillating gag possible, and a woman died. You've been following this closely?
I did, absolutely. And have you heard the audio?
No, I never have.
Look on the Sacramento Bee website, the uh-huh. newspaper there. They actually took the whole 4.5-hour show and edited it down to about 5 minutes. You can hear these pinhead morning guys. Any morning show that has one of those sidekicks named Fester.
He's not really named Fester.
That's what they call him on the air. I don't know if it's his real name.
No,
but
it's not his real name. They actually call him
Fester.
So it's not only a stupid reference, but it's a stupid reference that's 60 years old?
Something. That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
It's from the Addams Family, yes.
Oh, no. Oh, that's Uncle Fester.
Yeah.
Fester's from Gunsmoke.
No, that's Festus.
Festus, okay, Festus.
Yeah. Anyway, so they did this thing where they were giving away a Nintendo Wii, and people had to come in and drink water. And it was, you had to drink 8 ounces of water in 2 minutes, and then you had a 10-minute break, and you had to drink another 8 ounces of water. And the woman who died consumed over 2 gallons worth.
Mm-hmm. And in what period? Well, in 8 ounces, so we can do that math.
Ten minutes. So that would be 64 ounces how many in a gallon? 100.
Oh, Jiminy, now we're in trouble.
No, there's 128 ounces in a gallon because there's 32 in a quart, so she had 264. That took the whole show, four hours or so to do this.
And there's how many people are contestants?
I don't know how many contestants they had.
And they weren't allowed to pee.
No going to the bathroom.
Now, what was the famous mathematician who died from not going to the bathroom? Someone will write in, believe me. But he was in front of the king giving a speech, and he couldn't ask to be excused from the king. So he died there of this similar
thing. And did not get a Nintendo Wii as his prize. This woman, by the way, came in second and bailed for Justin Timberlake tickets. So again, you know the mentality of the people we're dealing with here, but the people on the radio, and this is the question I asked my audience, who's responsible? Is it the woman who should have known when her belly became so distended it looked like she was pregnant again, that she shouldn't be doing something like this, that it would jeopardize her own health?
I thought she was doing it for her kids, for the Wii. She wanted to win the Wii for
Okay,
her
but still.
I'm just saying.
Whatever she's doing it for, you should know at a certain point.
But I'm bothered by the Justin Timberlake tickets. That's what's freaking me out. That was the second prize?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm back on board.
They kind of bribed her for that and to bail out, because I think they had to end the show. And so she did, and the other woman who had consumed that much water ended up winning. But the question is whether she's personally responsible for what happened to her, or is the radio station responsible for what happened to her? Should they have known there was something? And when you listen to the audio on the Sacramento Bee website, you can hear one of the people on the show, I think the woman sidekick news person, traffic chick, whatever her title is on that show, she actually says, you know, we probably should have looked into this before we did this on the air.
Yeah, apparently one of the listeners called in and said, you know, this is kind of dangerous. Yeah. And I went, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, a nurse called in and told them that on the air, and they said, oh, that's okay. They signed a release. We're all right on that.
Oh, there you go.
And so, again, because I've worked in radio my whole life, I know that you can't do a big contest like this on the air without having management approve it. And management these days doesn't approve anything until they run it by the lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody above these pinhead radio morning guys mm-hmm. approved this. Why aren't their heads on the chopping block? Why, you know, the people who worked on the show, they were all fired, they were all scapegoated for this, and it's horrible that this woman died.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely horrible. But I want to know what was the decision-making chain that led to this thing going on the air without having any medical professionals, A, consult, and B, be present.
Yeah, I would think be present, a consult.
I mean, when you do your stage show, you have people who have shown you what was the right way to do everything that you're going to do it, and you make sure that the gag is right.
What we're really proud of is no one getting hurt.
Right.
You know? And there are freak accidents that are going to happen. You know, you can be, you know, Houdini's rule was he wouldn't do anything more dangerous than sitting in his living room. Because you can be killed sitting in your living room.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, that's a level of safety we feel comfortable with. But I think that the strict libertarian point of view, my nut point of view, would be that she is responsible. I think if you tell somebody, you know, I'll give you a case of beer if you can, you know, run across that traffic naked,
mm-hmm.
that the person has to take some responsibility for that.
I agree.
Although there's this problem, you know, when we pick someone from the audience and we tell them to come up on stage, there's this term they use, an insurance company, called assumption of risk.
Yep.
But it's not really that useful, because one of the things that people are doing is the information that they have is that we've been running the show at the Rio for a while.
Yes.
So probably it's like if you go on Fear Factor, you know, we're good friends with Joe Rogan. You go on Fear Factor, if they give you a bug to eat, You know it may be a disgusting bug. It may freak you out, but they're not giving you a poisonous spider to eat.
Yeah, you have some trust in them. Well, they wouldn't let me do this if it was dangerous.
Right.
And then you find out they didn't even check to find out if it was dangerous.
I found when we did Fear Factor, I could not try any of the stunts. It had to be Teller with me essentially trash talking. because they did not have a stuntman on staff who was 6 foot six and 285 pounds.
Yeah.
And a 6 foot four guy that was 120. And the producers said, we will not let Penn do any of these things if we've done it with somebody 4 inches shorter.
Mm.
That, simple, hardcore, boom, we will not allow it.
Yeah.
Absolute rule, because every single stunt we do here, stuntmen have to go through and try everything and make sure it's okay. So I want so badly to just say it was the woman's fault. And yet, if I were on a radio show and they said, Ben, you know, eat this disgusting bug, I would assume it was not poisonous.
Yeah, I think there's some contributory negligence on her part in that she kept on doing it after she started not feeling well. And you can hear that in the audio.
What I don't understand is about this whole thing, and I didn't see any articles that mentioned this, and it's my real question. Why couldn't you just pee? I mean, can you control your bladder? I can't.
No, I can't either.
Yeah, I know. There are times when I felt like if I did not make it to the bathroom, I would pee all over myself.
This woman went through a four-hour radio show without going to the bathroom. I've been doing this almost three decades. I've never done that. In fact, we had, in Days of Music Radio, we had certain long songs in case I'd eaten a burrito that night, you know?
Sure, that was the popularity of Inagata De Vida.
Yeah.
In the 60s.
Roundabout by Yes, 8 minutes and 29 seconds. I'm out.
The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Yes. All these, the original Like a Rolling Stone, all of these were, you know, you could write a sociological paper
yep.
that talks about how the popularity of songs, you've got to be in at 3:05. Unless you cross over to 8 minutes for the burrito songs, and then you've automatically got another leg up on
that. Would be the Stairway to Heaven thesis right
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
The only reason Stairway to Heaven was popular on the radio all those years is because radio people have horrible nutritional habits.
Exactly. But I mean, I would. We'll get some letters on this. PennRadio@gmail.com. People will write in because I think it becomes you can't hold your breath until you die.
Mm-hmm.
No one has that willpower.
Mm-hmm. Passed out and died.
Well, yeah, but where's the step where the bladder releases?
Well, probably at death, and we just didn't get that in the stories. You know, they probably didn't say, the mother of three, dead from water asphyxiation, also tonight's ending to the story.
But I consider myself to have a great deal of willpower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can do stuff. You know, I could probably hold my hand in a lighter till I got burned a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have control over my body. But
she didn't die because her bladder split.
It's essentially drowning internally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
It's a crazy thing.
I've been drinking this seltzer yeah, the whole time we've been talking.
It's got some salt in it. You should be okay.
It's the fact that if they'd given her, if she'd been drinking Gatorade, she'd been okay?
Yes, yeah. I believe that that's the case. If she'd been drinking Gatorade, yes.
Okay.
Oh, now some idiot radio guy somewhere is going, all right, tomorrow morning.
So, Pendulum, we're going to give away a Wii. If you can hold your Wii, you come in here and drink 8 ounces of Gatorade in 2 minutes and take a 10-minute break and then do it again. We'll give you a Wii right here on CBS Radio, Free FM, and I'm here with Paul Harris. And do you blame the radio station?
I think that there's some contributory negligence on her part, but mostly the radio station management has to take a lot more responsibility for this, and certainly if a lawyer cleared it, they should be disbarred.
Okay, well, there you go. And Michael Goodell, and my name is Ben Gillette. We're radio.
You okay? What happened there?
Yeah, we're radio guys.
Take a sip of water.
We're radio guys, Goodell. Give us this very clearly.
Yes.
Don't drink water if you listen to our show. Just don't drink any water ever. Is that clear?
That's clear.
Now we're safe. Don't drink water. This is Ben Gillette, CBS Radio, Free FM, and Michael Goodell telling you, don't drink water.
Don't drink water.
Don't drink water.